Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Classes of Mail. My name is Alan Gygax, and today we're going to continue reading from the ELM, the Employee and Labor Relations Manual. It's been satisfying for me to read this. It's like reading the M39, where I'm learning all of these things that management is supposed to do. And for you guys, for the listener, we have the additional benefit of I am editing this for you, because there's tons of stuff in the ELM that just don't apply or that are not relevant to the things you and I do. There's whole sections devoted to rural carriers, or maybe I'm thinking of the time. It doesn't matter. There's whole sections that you just, at least in my opinion, they're just not relevant. So we skip those. And now we are in the 400s, and things start to get a lot more relevant. So we are going to pick up at the first relevant section that I found in the 400s, which is 421.43, change actions. And this dates back to a topic from the previous ELM episode where we talked about, like, can CCAs be promoted to supervisors? I actually also talked to a CCA supervisor at my station today, and he told me essentially the same thing. But we'll get to that. Let me read the provision. 421.43, change actions. Promotion. The permanent assignment of an employee A, to an established position having a higher grade than the position to which the employee was previously assigned in the same schedule, or B, to a position with a higher than equivalent grade in another schedule. B, demotion. The permanent assignment due to unsatisfactory performance of an employee A, to an established position within the lower grade in the same schedule, or B, to a position with a lower equivalent grade in another schedule, also called disciplinary reduction. All right, so the deal with promotion is that CCAs apparently cannot take supervisory positions, not full-time. They have to take 204B positions, which are temporary supervisors that are still, like, in the carrier craft. And then once they convert to full-time regular, then they can go into full-time supervision. And that just happened to my station. We had a supervisor who was new and was a CCA, and he just converted to full-time regular, and so presumably he will be going into full-time supervision. So that's where we get our great supervisors. All right, moving on. 421.445, terms. And I just picked up on item I here, promotion. An increase in an employee's pay grade within a rate schedule or as a result of movement to a different rate schedule. Determined to be a promotion by Exhibit 418, which is this chart that was from earlier. Also, on the last one, you know, again, it talks about demotion, so it is absolutely possible to get these bad supervisors demoted. Whether management will do it voluntarily is another story. Well, voluntarily, they don't seem ever to be willing to do it, but it is at least on the table. All right, here we go. I think this is the single thing that I'm most excited about. 421.45, wage increases. Part D is quality step increase, which is an increase in addition to a periodic step increase granted on or before expiration of required waiting periods in recognition of extra competence. So it is actually possible for your supervisor to put you in for a raise before you get your next step increase because you're just doing such a great job. And there's stuff in here later that we're going to read about all the credits and plaudits and awards and crap like that that you can get for doing a good job. And dude, does your supervisor ever do those? That seems very unlikely to me. So this is something that I'm going to talk about at a stand-up at my station probably tomorrow. That, you know, we know all about the things that management can do when they think we're doing a bad job, but they also have powers to do things when we're doing a good job. Why don't they ever use those powers? Is it that we only do bad work? Because that's certainly the way management makes it seem. All right, moving on. 421.7, rate schedule summary and references. Exhibit 421.7, Rate Schedule Summary and References, outlines the rate schedule codes for the categories and subcategories of bargaining unit employees, their salary schedule acronyms, and their grade ranges. It also provides reference to ELM sections with the appropriate exhibits and explanations. So there are a bunch of initials here for what type of work you do, depending on what craft you're in. For example, if you are a postal nurse, then you are in rate schedule G. If you are a postal police officer, you are in rate schedule Y. And the one that's relevant to us is if you are a letter carrier, you are in rate schedule Q. And if you look at your pay stub, it will say Q and then level one or grade one or grade two. So most letter carriers are Q1. And then if you're a carrier technician or if for some reason you're getting higher level pay, then you should be Q2. And that's your pay schedule. I know where I work, the trainers are supposed to get level two pay, Q2, while they're doing training. So when I was in the Carrier Academy, the days that I would teach at the Carrier Academy, I would get paid essentially equivalent to a T6, Q2. If you are temporarily assigned to a higher level assignment, like you opted on a T6 swing, then you should be watching your paycheck to make sure you're at Q2 for the time that you're doing that work. And a little bit later, it'll get into exactly how that breaks down, like what time you're supposed to get the higher level pay and what time you're supposed to get the regular pay and so on. All right, next, here we get into the definitions for creditable service. 422.132, creditable service, the following provisions apply. A, postal service. Except as provided in this section, credit for advancement for step increases may be earned only by career employees in pay status on the rolls of the Postal Service for computing... Let me try that again. Postal Service. Except as provided in this section, credit for advancement for step increases may be earned only by career employees in pay status on the rolls of the Postal Service. For computing creditable service, the following applies. 1. Service week. In computing the required waiting period, each full service week beginning at 12:01 a.m. Saturday and ending at 12 midnight the following Friday is creditable. 2. Leave without pay. Periods of LWOP, leave without pay, of less than 13 weeks for which no step deferment is made are included with paid service in computing the waiting period of service. For more than 13 weeks, your step increases are deferred, and there's a chart in the next section that breaks it down, but essentially you can take leave without pay for up to 13 weeks and still stay on track for your next step increase. If you're in that situation, you're definitely going to want to double check this with your union president, your business agent, somebody who's in the know, because you don't want to lose credit for that time. 3, prior service. Employees reinstated or reemployed to a career position within 52 weeks of separation are allowed credit, not in excess of 52 weeks, for prior service provided. A, an equivalent increase was not received at the time. Oh, boy, I am having trouble with these complicated sentences. Okay, so you are given credit for up to 52 weeks of service, provided that A, an equivalent increase was not received at the time of reinstatement or reemployment, and B, prior service was not under a casual or temporary appointment. So like if you leave and come back, the way it sounds to me on here is that you just kind of pick up where you left off. And if there was already a raise between now and then, like maybe there was a general wage increase, then maybe you would just go, you know, to whatever the new wage is, and then you pick up right there. I got to imagine that's a pretty rare circumstance, and I don't fully understand the way this works. So if it comes up, get together with your union steward or president, and it's in the ELM 422.132. All right, next, military duty. An employee who returns to postal duty following a separation or leave for military duty receives credit for the period of military duty as if duty with the Postal Service had been continuous. So that's a cool thing, right? You're out serving the military. You don't get docked time credit for not being at the post office. It's the least they can do. All right. C, injury compensation. An employee on official absence due to an injury compensable under the rules of the Office of Workers' Compensation Programs, OWCP, receives credit for the period of absence as if duty with the Postal Service had been continuous. So there you go. You get an OWCP claim where you get hurt at work, and you don't lose credit for that time. D, union officials. Employees on LWOP to devote full or part-time to a union signatory or to a union signatory to a collective bargaining agreement with the Postal Service are to be credited with step increases as if they had been in a pay status. So there you go. You take a full-time job or even a part-time job down at the union hall, and you will get credit for that time, and you'll still get your step increases. Next, 422.133, leave without pay. The following provisions apply. A, when an employee has been on LWOP for 13 weeks or more during the waiting period for receipt of a periodic step increase and has not been on military furlough, on the rolls of OWCP, or on official union business, the scheduled date for the employee's next step increase is deferred as follows. And then there's a chart that follows this, and it essentially shows that for every quarter of the year that you miss after the first quarter, your step increase gets pushed back by a quarter. So again, it looks like as long as you miss less than a quarter, less than 13 weeks, then you'll be able to stay right on track with your step increases. B, for periods of LWOP that encompass an entire pay period, the full charge of 80 hours is applied. For partial pay periods, absence from scheduled service on a day is counted as one calendar day. Only whole days of LWOP are counted. Fractional days on which the employee has work hours or paid leave and takes LWOP are not counted in calculating the total LWOP. So this is something you're going to want to consider. If you're starting to run out of sick leave or run out of annual leave, you may want to take partial days of annual or sick and the other part of the day LWOP so that you can kind of extend out your active period before you're on full-time leave without pay. Because it says here, you know, like if you take 4 hours of annual leave and 4 hours of leave without pay, well, that counts as being on a paid status for that day, and that does not count toward your total leave without pay. So that's a way that you may be able to kind of work the system if you're running super low on leave and you're out on medical or something like that. Next, 422.142, written management order. Any employee, except one of those covered in 432.2, who is temporarily assigned to a higher level work, is given PS Form 1723, assignment order, stating beginning and approximate termination and directing the employee to perform the duties of the higher level position. The written order is accepted as authorization for higher grade pay. The failure of management to give a written order is not grounds for denial of the higher level pay if the employee was otherwise directed to perform the duties of the higher level position. So this is relevant to you if you opt on, say, a carrier technician position. You are entitled to that higher level pay even if management doesn't put you in for it. You should put in, watch your pay, make sure you're getting that higher level pay. And if you don't, then you're going to want to initiate a grievance to make sure you get that pay. And I'm not positive if this is true for PTFs. The way some other sections were worded, it got a little confusing for me. And this is my first time reading through it. So if you're a PTF, you may want to double check that. Well, if you're anybody, you may want to double check that, right? Who knows if what I'm saying is, you know, I'm reading this, I'm interpreting it, and I'm figuring it out along with you. Next, 422.143, rate of pay. Rates are as follows. A, part-time flexible employees. A part-time flexible employee remains a part-time flexible employee while temporarily assigned to a higher level position. The employer neither has nor acquires a regular work schedule and is paid at the part-time flexible hourly rate for the higher level position. So presumably, if you are a PTF at grade whatever, then you would go up to step two as a PTF. Ah, so this answers the question that I had on my first read through. Look at that, reading it twice helps to understand it a little bit better. So the PTF gets PTF pay, but it would be like PTF grade two if they did higher level work. B, regular employees. Rules for pay for temporary higher level work depends on the factors below. One, assignment in PS schedule. A PS employee who is that's got to mean Postal Service. A PS employee who is temporarily assigned to higher level work in the PS schedule is paid at the higher level for time actually spent on such job. The employee's higher level or the employee's higher level rate is determined as if he or she had been promoted to the position. So again, if you're doing that carrier technician work, then for the time that you're on that swing, you should be getting Q2 pay. Two, assignment to other schedule. The rate of pay for service at a higher grade position in other than the PS schedule is determined in accordance with promotion rules for the salary schedule in which the higher level position is placed. So if you get put in some temporary, like, I don't know, technical job, then you're beholden to the rules of pay for that job. But while you're working that job, you should be getting that pay. Three, service in several positions. If higher level service is performed in more than one position in a pay period, the appropriate rate for each wage level is determined and paid in accordance with the actual time worked at each level. So your pay period can have more than one wage level on it. The time that you did this job, you get this pay. The time that you did that job, you get that pay, and so on. So like, for example, you could be a full-time regular carrier, and so you're getting paid at Q1 for the time that you're the full-time regular. And then you could temporarily opt on a T6 swing. So you're a carrier technician, and so for the time that you're on that, now you're getting Q2 pay in that same pay period. And then you could, for reasons unknown to me, take a position as a 204B. And then while you're doing that 204B work, you would get paid whatever that is. I don't know. I presume they pay them in like nuts and Bitcoin or something. Anyway, so that's how that would work. Next, annual and sick leave pay. Leave pay for employees temporarily assigned to a higher level position depends on the term of the assignment as follows. And this essentially mirrors what's in the contract as well. A, short-term temporary assignments. These employees, except those covered by 422.8, are entitled to approved annual and sick leave paid at the higher level rate for a period not to exceed 3 days for each occurrence, provided that they are not replaced while on leave and that they resume the assignment upon returning to work. So let's say you've opted on a carrier technician position and you're going to be on it for 3 weeks, but you call out sick for a day. Well, that day that you're on sick leave, you should get paid sick leave at Q2 instead of Q1. And the division for long-term and short-term, I don't know if it's covered later or if it was already covered, but it's 30 days is the cutoff. Anything under 30 is short-term. When you hit 30, that becomes long-term. All right, so sick leave and annual leave pay for long-term temporary assignments. These employees are entitled to approved annual and sick leave paid at the higher level rate for the full period of leave, provided that they resume the assignment upon returning to work. So you're on this carrier technician swing for a long time, maybe 3 months because the person's out on medical. You could go on vacation for a full week and you get that higher level pay, that Q2 pay for the whole time that you're on vacation, as long as when you come back, you're still working that higher level job. Five, holiday leave pay. Full-time employees are paid for the holiday at the rate of the higher level, provided that they perform higher level service both on the workday preceding and the workday following the holiday. Otherwise, the employee is paid for the holiday at the rate appropriate for his or her regular position. Six, holiday worked pay. If an employee performs authorized service at the higher grade on a holiday, the employee is paid at the rate for the higher grade position, in addition to holiday leave pay. Next, 422.145, benefits. The following benefits apply. A, terminal leave payments. Terminal leave payments resulting from death are paid at the higher grade for any employee except one of those covered by 422.9 who is temporarily assigned to a higher grade position on his or her last day in a duty status. So if you feel that the end is near, try to get yourself on a higher level assignment. B, retirement deductions. Retirement deductions are determined from the basic annual salary and any additional basic higher level pay the employee is receiving for the pay period. seek continuation of pay, like injury compensation. An employee who is eligible for continuation of pay as a result of an on-duty injury and who is serving in a higher level position when injured will receive such payments at the higher level rate. And there's a big section in here that covers how your pay is handled when you're changing between a regular carrier and a carrier technician in either direction. And basically, you keep your same grade, you keep your same progress toward the step increase. It's just that your pay moves up or down by that 2.1% percent differential. If you want to see the chart, check it out in 422 point, somewhere in like near the end of 422. Next, 432.3, work schedules and overtime limits. 432.31, basic work week. The basic work week for full-time bargaining unit employees is defined in the applicable labor agreements. Indeed, it is defined in our contract. Postmasters and exempt employees are assigned as needed. Otherwise, the basic full-time work week consists of 5 regularly scheduled 8-hour days within a service week. Note, the daily 8-hour schedule may not extend over more than 10 consecutive hours. 432.32, maximum hours allowed. All right, guys, so this is one that gets cited a lot in our so-called 1260 violations, and this is where this comes from. 432.32, maximum hours allowed. Except as designated in labor agreements for bargaining unit employees or in emergency situations as determined by the postmaster general or designee, employees may not be required to work more than 12 hours in one service day. In addition, the total hours of daily service, including scheduled work hours, overtime, and meal time, may not be extended over a period longer than 12 consecutive hours. All right, so that means that if you are anybody except a big list overtime carrier, you are capped at 11 and a half work hours plus your 30 minutes for lunch. That's it. That's the hard limit. And, you know, grievance settlement after arbitration settlement or whatever all says that, like, this is a hard limit that can't be exceeded. Of course, management does it anyway. And this is allegedly something that, well, it's something that may be addressed in the new contract where once we hit that 60-hour or that 12-hour limit, that we can just go home without repercussions. It remains to be seen whether that will actually make it into the contract. Essentially, that's just an enforcement mechanism for what's already in the contract. Like the fact that management just ignores the contract is why we would have to make a special carve-out to say, dude, if you violate the contract, you can't hold us responsible for doing what it says in the contract. All right, so anyway, again, this is where that 12-hour limit comes from. If you are an ODL carrier on the overtime desired list, you have a 12-work-hour limit. So technically, you can be at work for 12 and a half hours. Everybody else, including CCAs, PTFs, has a 12-hour limit, 11 and a half hours of work, 30 minutes of lunch. 432.33, meal time. Except in emergency situations or where service conditions preclude compliance, no employee may be required to work more than 6 continuous hours without a meal or rest period of at least 1/2 hour. So the wording here, may not be required, is where people fight over the meaning of this provision. Like, if you do you have to take your lunch? The way I read it, you may not be required, or no employee may be required to work more than 6 consecutive hours without a meal or rest period. That means they can't force you to skip your lunch, but it doesn't prohibit you from voluntarily skipping your lunch if you work more than 6 hours. So that's my interpretation of the language here. This is something that has probably already been fought over at your station. And you should look at prior grievance settlements to see what the current status is of not taking your lunch. 432.43, service day. The service day is a calendar day, 12:01 a.m. to 12 midnight. An employee's service day depends on his or her schedule as follows. Full-time employees. For a full-time employee whose regular schedule begins at 8 p.m. or later, the service day is the next calendar day. And all work hours, including pre-shift work hours, as well as leave hours, are recorded on that calendar day. If the employee's regularly scheduled day begins prior to 8 p.m., the service day is the calendar day on which the schedule begins, and all work and leave hours are recorded on that calendar day. And it's the same provision for PTFs and casual employees, CCAs. Not as carriers, none of us really start work that late, but that's the rule. Again, I'm erring on the side of including more. Next, there's another one that carriers will argue over. Management will try to pretend it doesn't exist, but here is the actual rule. 432.46, 5-minute leeway rule. 432.461, explanation. Although each employee at installations with time recording devices is required to clock in and clock out on time, congestion at time clocks or other conditions can sometimes cause clock time to vary slightly from the established work schedule. Therefore, a deviation may be allowed from the scheduled time for each clock ring up to 0.08 hours, or 5 minutes. However, the sum of deviations for the scheduled tour must not exceed 0.08 hours, or 5 minutes. So that means that if you clock in as much as 5 minutes late, say you're supposed to start at 8 a.m., you can clock in as late as 8:05 and still clock out at 4:30 p.m. and you get your 8-hour day. Likewise, if you clock in at 8 a.m., you could clock out at 4:25 p.m. and get your 8-hour day. So that's how this works. 432.462, applicability. This 5-minute, this is an important caveat here. This 5-minute leeway rule applies only to full-time and part-time regular schedule employees. Part-time flexible, casual, transitional, and temporary employees, it doesn't say so in here, but also CCAs, are allowed the 5-minute privilege for clocking purposes subject to ELM 432.464B, but are paid on the basis of their actual clock rings. All right, so you get 5 minutes to clock in or to clock out, but you don't get paid that 8 hours. You get paid the clock rings that you actually work, like if you're a PTF or a CCA. The 5-minute leeway rule applies only to the scheduled tour of duty. If an employee works in an overtime status that is contiguous with the scheduled tour, the 5-minute leeway does not apply to any clock rings for the entire tour. Employees in this situation are paid for their actual clock time, unless the time is disallowed as described in 432.711. However, the 5-minute leeway rule does apply to temporary schedules, including any out-of-schedule overtime hours outside of and instead of the employee's regular schedule. All right, so what this means is, essentially, as long as you're within 5 clicks of 8 hours, you're going to be paid for 8 hours. Or, I'm sorry, 8 clicks, 5 minutes of 8 hours. You get paid for 8 hours as long as you are a full-time regular with a regular schedule. If you work more than 8 hours, then you just get whatever hours you actually worked. 432.463, adjustment. After extending clock rings, if, in the case of a full-time regular schedule employee, the clock ring totals for the tour are between 7.92 and 8.08 hours, the time should be adjusted to 8 hours. If a part-time regular schedule employee's clock time is between 0.08 hours less than or greater than his or her established schedule, then the time should be adjusted to the employee's scheduled tour. Yeah, so a part-time regular, somebody like in the collections department where I work, they would get the same leeway for whatever their schedule is, as long as you're just working the regular scheduled hours. 432.464, special cases. The 5-minute leeway rule for night differential and Sunday premium hours is peculiar and requires special attention. A, in the case of night differential, eligible employees are to be paid night differential for the exact amount of time they worked between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. However, in no case can the total night differential hours for bargaining unit employees exceed the total hours for the tour. If the only reason that part of an employee's clock time falls between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. is that the employee clocked in 0.08 hours less or 0.08 hours or less before 6 a.m. or 0.08 hours or less after 6 p.m., then the employee is not eligible to be paid night differential. B, Eligible bargaining unit employees receive Sunday premium for all hours worked during a scheduled tour, any part of which falls on a Sunday. The amount of Sunday premium cannot exceed the hours worked, nor can it exceed 8 hours per tour. If the only reason that part of an employee's clock time falls on Sunday is that the employee clocked in 0.08 outside of their regular schedule, then the employee is not eligible for any Sunday premium. 432.465 exception. On some cases, an employee may have a combination of work and paid leave. In such cases, the five-minute leeway rule does not apply, and the employee is credited with the actual hours worked. The balance of the employee's scheduled tour is charged to sufficient leave to give the employee credit for the total scheduled tour. And now, another item of great controversy between carriers and management. 432.53, City Letter Carriers, the 701 rule. Here is the actual argued about 701 rule. Listen up. A city carrier who actually works more than 7 hours, but less than 8 hours of a regular scheduled day, and who is officially excused from the completion of the 8-hour tour, is credited with 8 hours work time for pay purposes. This is known as the 701 rule. That's it. That's the whole thing. So, if you work at least 7 hours and your supervisor says, you're done for the day, you can go ahead and go home, boom, you get paid 8 hours. That's that. As long as you worked at least 7 hours and 1 minute. That is the 701 rule. All right. And it is worth noting that if you are someone who is officially excused from the completion of the 8-hour tour, so this has to be done in cooperation with management. All right, next we get into guarantee time, but we're already at half hour, and I think that's going to do for today. So there was definitely some interesting stuff in there, some things that are very relevant to what carriers argue about, and especially what they argue with management about. So we will pick up on the next episode with guaranteed time. Thanks for listening, guys. I'll catch you next time.